Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by Copper and Kings, pure copper pot-distilled American brandy, aged in Kentucky bourbon barrels. For more information, visit copperandkings.com.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening and welcome to Fomen About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Isaac.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Mary, today tastes lovely. Thanks for being you. I'm going to go straight. Let's go straight to what you're fermenting right now, and then we'll go into some events and announcements.
Okay, so last week, if you listened to the last episode, what episode are we on tonight, by the way?
161 or 162?
I believe it's 162.
Damn, we need to look at that every time before we go on the air. We always forget. Anyway, last week...
too many to
161, mention. It's 161. Right, hey, 161. Same backwards and forward.
So last week, episode 160, we just talked about what we've been fermenting and what we're planning to ferment and some seasonal stuff. And I've been hooked on fermented cashew cheese. I haven't actually ventured into other nuts, but I'm starting with cashew cheese and kind of perfecting that process. And I made several batches of it for the Ferment Festival, which was recently in Brooklyn, here in Brooklyn. So cashew cheese seems to be a lacto-driven fermentation. So it's using one or more strains of lactobacillus bacteria to generate lactic acid, lower the pH, and, you know, also create a bunch of aromas and flavors associated with fermentation. So you're basically making kind of a slightly tart, umami-ish cashew paste when you ferment. So a lot of times people will start with anything from Rejuvelac, which is a lacto-driven natural fermentation that you can do from different types of grain. Or you can start with probiotic tablets. You
or
can start with
Kombucha or Whey.
Yeah, or lacto... brine from pickles. So my first batch, I did some probiotic tablets and lacto brine. This batch, I just wanted to do straight probiotic tablets. So I used a vegan probiotic tablet. Jaro is the brand name. I think I wrote it down. It's the one that's like 3.4 billion is the strength, I guess, is what, for lack of a better word. Anyway, capsules. So I started with 1.5 pounds of cashews, soaked them overnight. I then strained them, rinsed them with chlorine-free water. I added 5 Jaro, these Jaro capsules, and blended it all in a food processor till I got a really nice, pretty smooth paste. I then set my sous vide stick at 106 degrees, and I ended up doing overnight. They had obviously been fermenting, but I thought, hey, why not go a little longer? So I ended up around 18 to 20 hours. If you don't have a sous vide stick, you can do this in any way that you can maintain a temperature somewhere between, I'd say, 104 and 108. So you could do it in an oven with a light bulb on or with a grow mat or anything like that. Anything where you can keep a reasonably steady temperature.
Anywhere you could make a yogurt.
Yeah, exactly. You could use a yogurt maker as well.
You can use a cooler filled with hot water.
Yes, anything. Obviously, you want to keep the... I did it in a jar, so you want to keep the paste away from the water. Anyway, so then I split it into a batch... 3 batches, so 8 ounces of cashew paste each, already fermented. I added a teaspoon of, or somewhere between a teaspoon and half a tablespoon of nutritional yeast flakes, just for a little bit extra oomph. Oh, I also added salt, actually. I left that part out. I did add some salt. And I didn't measure it, but I will next time. I'm still tweaking the recipe. So I added some salt when I added the Jarro capsules, the probiotic capsules. I split into three batches. The first one I added nutritional yeast flakes and a little bit of Wright's liquid smoke, the hickory flavor. So Wright's is a liquid smoke that is just water and smoke. So it doesn't have any additives or preservatives. And I think it works really, really well. So that's a smoked variety. The second one I added nutritional yeast flakes again, a little bit of my aged house-made rice miso, and then some, Rachel can correct my pronunciation of this, shishimi togarashi.
It means like seven spices, I believe.
Yeah, it's a Japanese spice. Mm-hmm. I got it at Kalushian's in Manhattan, which is probably my favorite place to buy spices in the city. And then the third one, again, another 8 ounces of cashew paste, fermented cashew paste, a little bit of nutritional yeast flakes, and I used a peri peri spice blend, which is a North African spice blend. So we're actually eating them. I brought them for everybody to try. I wanted to get some more opinions, but they're freaking delicious.
So we apologize in advance for any crunching you might hear on air, because they are amazing. Especially, they're all really good, but especially the smoked one really tastes like a smoked Gouda or a smoked cheddar. And I think if you didn't tell somebody that it wasn't cheese, they would not know.
Yeah, I feel pretty good. So I think, you know, these are definitely easy to do. It's really easy if you have a yogurt making setup or a sous vide stick. But even if you don't, it's a really easy, reliable, quick way to do a fermented cashew cheese. I'm going to work on, there's some other natural additives that you can use. Agar-agar is a natural vegetarian gelatin. So I haven't broken into manipulating the texture, but those are going to be my next experiments.
But this texture on these three are noticeably different than the
Yeah, it's pretty firm. I think because I only use the probiotic powder, I didn't add any additional liquid. So it's a little firmer. It's more like a fresh goat cheese texture, I think, mm-hmm. almost. Mm-hmm. Only a little, maybe a slightly aged goat cheese, a little bit firmer. So the texture is pretty nice. I molded them. I just wrapped them in cheesecloth, and then I have a silicone, like these little mini loaf pan, and I just use that to kind of mold them in with a cheesecloth wrapped around them, which I think, you know, makes it a nice presentation, I guess. More cheese-like.
It's like a cheese platter right here in the studio.
So we have a couple quick announcements, most of which you've heard before. As far as beer and brewing action, Savor Craft Beer is the American craft beer and food experience that's put on by the Brewers Association. That is June 3rd and 4th in Washington, D.C. It's a fabulous event, and there are tickets still available. So if you're interested in going, that is Savor, S-A-V-O-R, craftbeer.com. Homebrew Con, which is the Homebrewers Conference put on the American Homebrewers Association. Chris and I will be there. I'll be doing a book signing either Friday or Saturday. I can't remember where. And I'm giving a seminar on Thursday on shortcut sours. So we'll be talking a lot more about lacto. That is on June 9th through 11th in Baltimore, and registration is still open for that. So if you are interested in going, it's going to be a great time. There's a ton of great seminars. There's always a ton of amazing homebrews pouring, all kinds of great stuff. That's homebrewcon.org. And then last but not least, Big Brew.
Not last but not least, but very importantly, and definitely not least, May 7th, 2016, Big Brew Day. In 1988, the Congress announced the first Saturday in May as National Homebrew Day. So the American Homebrewers Association created AHA Big Brew as an annual event to celebrate National Homebrew Day around the world. It's held each year on that Saturday, and there are a bunch of recipes that a lot of people like, all brew in their own respective areas, or you just get together and homebrew.
And if you aren't currently part of a group and you're interested in attending a Big Brew Day, the American Homebrewers Association has a lookup, so you can find a Big Brew near you. So if you go to homebrewersassociation.org, events, Big Brew for National Homebrew Day, they have a number of areas across the country as well as in other countries.
Queens Beer Week is coming up May 13th to 22nd, and there's a lot of fun stuff happening. And Queens has quite an incredible list of breweries on their roster, all very different, very unique, and very close to one another. It starts on the 13th, and it's going to be pretty awesome. I guess just look for it.
How many breweries do we have based out of Queen now?
I don't remember.
We have at least 7, if not 8.
Mm-hmm.
No, 9. I think there's 9 now. So, yeah. Probably.
And by the time this comes out, maybe more.
I know, exactly. Yeah. All right.
I am very, very, very excited about today's episode. I've been a fan of this gentleman for quite some time. And lo and behold, he also wrote a book on other things that we are very, very, very interested in. Let us present the Fermented Man, Derek Dillinger.
Welcome.
Welcome to the studio.
How's it going, guys?
You are the brewer for Kent Falls Brewing. I love the work you do with Kent Falls. But this book is a journey of eating nothing but fermented foods for a year. Before we dive right into that, who are you? Where? How did you get here or to that point?
In
a tweet or less. Yeah.
A lot of coincidences and strange occurrences, I guess. I've been homebrewing for 5 years now. All in all, not actually that long. I've been writing a beer blog called Bear Flavored, Bear Like the Animal. And through that and just getting immersed in the world of fermentation and meeting brewers and other people interested in fermentation, both these things came about, getting involved in Kent Falls Brewing Company and this extreme diet adventure that I undertook for the book. There's really no easy short explanation to that whole backstory.
Well, when you started on the adventure for the book, that was around the same time as you were going through a career change to Kent Falls, is that?
Yeah, more or less. I was helping run a homebrew shop in Beacon, New York for a little while and trying to explore the world of professional brewing and just really getting obsessed with the world of fermentation, which led to the idea for the book, which led to me kind of just making this big jump into both realms of things.
Mm-hmm. So what was the inspiration behind the book or kind of the concept of eating nothing but fermented foods and beverages?
It started really, really simply, actually, with just this realization that I went to a natural food market and basically just bought a jar of sauerkraut. It was red cabbage sauerkraut, a lot different from the sauerkraut that most people have grown up with. Soggy, you know, soggy, unpleasant stuff on hot dogs at ball games and so forth. Bought this jar of red cabbage sauerkraut and was reading the jar and how proud it was that it contained microbes and that it contained lactobacillus, which from brewing I knew, you know, knew what it did in the context of beer, and probably was vaguely aware that it, you know, made sauerkraut and made yogurt and all these other things, but I hadn't really consciously thought about that and the overlap between all these different foods, and just sort of all of a sudden clicked that, like, oh man, this bacteria makes like half the things we eat. It's like just this, you know, just that one bacteria strain, not to mention fermentation in general. It's kind of all encompassing. And that train of thought just sort of snowballed to where I, like a few days later, I just kind of had this thought experiment pop into my head where, like, you could probably just live off of fermented foods. I don't know why you try to do that. Like, maybe that's a book idea. It just quickly snowballed into, like, yeah, I mean, that there's that many fermented foods out there. It's that universal that it really, like, it makes up every type of food we could eat.
Mm-hmm. So the year of fermentation that you did from all of 2014, correct?
2014, yeah.
All of 2014. It wasn't for like any health reasons. What was the purpose of it?
So, like I said, that idea kind of sprang out of my mind, and again, by accident, pretty much, it turned into an actual book idea rather than a half-joking thought experiment that I had. I decided to pursue it, and I wasn't trying to rectify any particular health concerns. You know, I didn't have anything in my diet specifically that was terribly wrong that I was trying to address. I was probably, like most Americans, like a, you know, we're more conscious of what we eat lately, but there's so much conflicting dietary advice. It's hard to balance it all and figure out what the perfectly healthy diet is. But, you know, beyond exploring that and just trying to evolve my diet into something better and better all the time, I wasn't trying to address anything in particular. I wanted to use the idea to grab the attention of people who might not be immersed in fermentation already, give them something to latch onto and question, a reason to pick up the book and ask, like, how could you live off of fermented food? So it's definitely a narrative hook for the book. It's something that I want to use to draw on people who aren't going to buy one of Sandra Katz's fermentation guides. That kind of relies on, or that kind of necessitates a little commitment that, you know, you're already willing to go home and ferment some foods in your kitchen on your own. You're already sort of at a base level of knowledge of fermentation. I want to go with this book even, you know, below that to a type of consumer, type of reader who might just be browsing in Barnes & Noble, has knows, you know, knows the word fermentation. They've heard it before. They might not know it extends beyond beer or maybe cheese or bread, and is kind of so flummoxed by this the concept that someone could live off fermented food that hopefully they're interested in reading the book, learning more about it. Hopefully they enjoy it and maybe then move on to buying a guidebook or maybe wanting to make sauerkraut at home. But it's really something that's so important that it shouldn't be relegated to only people who are willing to engage with this as a DIY hobby. It's right. something even more yeah. important than that.
Although I will say that as somebody who ferments a lot of different things, that you... It's a very interesting book. Like I thought. I mean, you taste good. A lot of yeah. things
went
that
right. above and
you went a lot of areas, and right. you made it very relevant. And it is a nice, you know, it's a, yes. there's a story there too. As
I,
well
I wanted to be, yeah, I wanted obviously you wanted to be interesting for people mm-hmm. who do know fermentation mm-hmm. as well as you guys who are intermediates who are beginners. Hopefully, you know, an interesting story, regardless of
right.
how familiar
absolutely.
It is.
Absolutely.
It's very anecdotal. Yeah. It's very personal with your. But you do a great job of also explaining the history behind some of the ferments that
yes.
you end up getting to, as well as what it means to you and kind of where it applies to your experience, which is deep. It comes from a beer person first.
Right.
Which is kind of like, I love this book because it kind of embodies kind of what we're doing with this show to me. Like, we're learning through all these things. With
yeah, actually, because especially in the book, because you mentioned that, like, at the beginning, you've just basically ever made beer and, like, sauerkraut. Mm-hmm. And then you start with vegetables, and then you suddenly explore the rest of the world, and I feel like that could be, like, any of the readers.
Hopefully, yeah. Yeah.
The book we're talking about is called The Fermented Man.
Yes.
When does it come out?
Comes out July 19th.
July 19th, okay. Yeah. We feel blessed to have an advanced copy here mm-hmm. talking about it. We're going to take a very quick break and come back on Ferment About It with Derek Dillinger.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, the executive producer of Heritage Radio Network, also the host of Full Service Radio, and I want to talk to you about brandy. I was lucky enough to visit Louisville, and we all know Kentucky is whiskey territory. However, the best thing I had to drink was brandy. I got to visit Copper and King's Distillery, and they make pure copper pot distilled American brandy aged in Kentucky bourbon barrels, matured with rock and roll. That's right. Sonic aging. They're playing music to the barrels. The stuff is double distilled, non-chill filtered, unadulterated by bois, sugar, or caramel color. And this stuff is feisty, rambunctious, with a long, smooth finish. The stuff isn't made exactly in the style of an international brandy or a cognac. It's more along the lines of an American whiskey. I can really be honest here and tell you, I'm not just reading you an ad, I'm giving you a tip. American brandy, you're not seeing it everywhere. Copper and Kings is doing it incredibly well, and they're cool people. The distillery is full of incredible art. Like I said, they're playing rock and roll to the barrels. So again, Copper and Kings, pure copper, pot distilled American brandy, aged in Kentucky bourbon barrels. That's copperandkings.com. Drink it neat, put it in a cocktail, sub it for your brown spirits, experiment, have fun, get funky. This stuff is awesome.
Welcome back to episode 161 of Ferment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We're here in the studio with Derek Dillinger, author of The Fermented Man. And a fermented man. Apparently, no. You smell just fine. It's great.
It's been a while since 2014.
Yeah, right. So going into this, how did you decide what day one was? Did you plan out your first month of diet?
Not meal by meal. Before I started, I mean, it seemed to make sense to do it January 1 as a full year. So in about the beginning of December of 2013, I spent a couple weekends, mainly one major fermentation session, one weekend, just driving around to farmers markets, local grocery stores, brought home a whole giant pile of produce to ferment. As kind of the, you know, veggies are the easiest way to get started fermenting, as most people find. And, you know, I just made this giant, huge array of different veggie ferments, kind of thinking naively that I'd sort of be able to live off of that to an extent, which I quickly realized, oh yeah, sauerkraut doesn't really have many calories, as it turns out.
Yeah, you burn more.
Not something that you really, you know, you think about all the fermentation health effects, and people, I think, encountering this, the concept of this diet for my book, not really thinking like, oh yeah, all the things that we normally talk about as like the healthy side of fermented foods are not really things you can actually live off of. Kimchi is like more of a condiment than an actual food.
Right.
I made this giant array of different veggie ferments to prepare myself. Tried a bunch of experiments all at once, some of which worked, some of which didn't. But, I kind of had a rough game plan. Different things I feared I would start out and try and build upon, depending on what I liked and how I was, you know, succeeding with my first few weeks of meals.
What? There's a lot of questions I have. So I guess what was a big stumbling block, I guess, that you found?
Yeah,
so you said calories, like realizing that you couldn't get enough calories from sauerkraut and kimchi.
Right.
So what was some other like kind of stumbling block or big realizations along the way?
There were a lot of
either good or bad.
Yeah, there were a lot of mental stumbling blocks. One of the things I talked about in the book that was really interesting from a writing perspective, much harder in a having to live through a perspective, is just how going on such an arbitrary narrow diet rearranges your concept of what a meal is, and how we just in general talk about meals as these kind of assembled elaborate things that's just built into the human consciousness, as we never really eat just kind of simple. I mean, we do, some of us more so than others, but meals have become more of an elaborate cooked framework of food rather than just simple things on their own. And with this diet especially, I was eating more just simple things on their own. So bread and cheese and maybe some cured meat, maybe sauerkraut or pickles or olives or something on the side. So covering all the food groups that you'd normally eat in a meal, but just on their own, like kind of a platter you would get at a party normally. But, you know, so something mentally told me, like, this isn't a meal. Like, you're not eating enough food. When really it was kind of the same thing that I would be eating if I made a sandwich. It was this weird kind of mental rearrangement of conceptualizing what a meal was and eating that same thing over and over. Or eventually my mind was like, no, that's, this is weird. This is not what you were doing before. Why are you doing this? And I had to adjust into eating just this simpler, stripped down type of diet. And I eventually had to tell myself, like, there's nothing wrong with this. This is the same types of food you'd be eating anyway. And the point is that fermentation can be all types of food. It's just you can't eat it in the same forms that you normally would when you're, you know, cooking with any materials available to you.
Right. It's kind of like you're eating those fancy deconstructed desserts or appetizers for every meal.
Right. It's kind of, yeah, what you would think of as appetizers or, you know, again, like kind of party platters or, you know, yeah, the type of appetizers you get at a fancy Italian restaurant or something for every meal. But it's actually not really a bad thing, I don't think. I think there are some merits to eating simpler. I think that could be a good thing overall for people to embrace more in their diets, is just eating things that aren't so elaborate, that are like good core fundamental foods and just their inherent state without worrying so much about preparing these elaborate dishes out of them. It kind of forces you to eat less and just eat more true to what the foods are by themselves.
Right. What they're meant to be. Yeah, you're eating more kind of thoughtfully.
Right.
Too.
Exactly. Yeah. Cool. And it's also easier. I spent like a whole week camping in Vermont in the fall and just kind of pulling foods out of a cooler, just eating some bread and some butter and cheese, and like it's kind of nice not having to think about preparing food either, just eating these simple things on their own.
True. Yep.
Yeah. In the book, you mentioned the theory of three simple complex foods.
Yeah.
You want to touch on that a little bit?
What are the three simple complex foods, and what does that mean?
Hopefully I do a much better job of explaining this in the book than I'll be able to do off the top of my head. It was a fun theory that I was really proud of myself when I thought of this. And again, I'd probably go into it a lot more in the book. I think you could probably pick this out with any culinary tradition. Obviously, as a Westerner, I chose Western foods that we're familiar with for these examples. So this is not to say these are the only examples, but in the book, the three foods that I talk about for this are beer, bread, and cheese as these examples of fermented foods, or, you know, what most people just view as kind of core basic foods that don't exist really without human intervention. Other fermented foods are just kind of themselves in a slightly altered form. Sauerkraut is just cabbage that's been allowed to ferment, which is something that can happen in nature, you know, without human intervention. Beer, bread, and cheese, they can exist without human intervention. They're all kind of engineered, and microbes take the engineered, altered form of their roots and then again transform them into a new fermented state that kind of requires these multiple layers of the microbial world, the human world, all working to achieve these very elaborate elaborate foods that are, you know, we think of them as very simple, and that they are these kind of core, simple, pure, essential foods that have these really nuanced, complex flavors that I think are partially due to their sort of artificially engineered state. Right. I think you don't get from other even fermented foods, because there's so much elaboration that has to happen for these foods to even exist in the first place.
Right.
What was one of your most challenging fermented foods to eat? Like that one thing, we all have them. We all have things that we've tried and we will never go back to. What was it for you?
As far as like,
it could be in the book or anything since, like in the whole world.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a lot of things that I really wanted to make work and that weren't necessarily horrendous, but that just weren't quite cutting it. A lot of veggies that I wanted to be able to eat, veggies and fruits, I guess, they just take a weird, you know, certain things take a weird texture when you ferment them, and you want to embrace that fermented version of it, and it's just not quite doing it for you.
Especially if you've had them in another form.
Right. Like, I love radishes, and they just get kind of soggy and a little weird when you ferment them, at least in my experiences. I've never had anyone else's fermented radishes, so maybe I just suck at them. And I kept trying, like, I kept thinking, like, if I can master some kind of really simple, like, lacto or something fermented rice and bean dish, that'd be, like, such an easy core food that, like, well, people live off in college anyway, you know, like, something real simple like that. And same thing, it just would take this weird, weird, unappealing texture that I couldn't quite get into that much.
Yeah.
Trying to think.
Mary and I are headed to Iceland, and I hear you went there, and I'm surprised that maybe the shark is not on your list.
Well, that's that's a great point. I would probably try the shark again. Yeah. I would say there are things that I hated. I wouldn't even say I disliked the shark. It was an interesting experience. Probably the worst thing, the one thing I could never eat again, would be Chinese century eggs.
Oh yeah.
Based on the appearance and the texture of them, they take on this like geode green appearance, and the yolk is just this, it looks like,
you said it was something out of H.P. Lovecraft.
H.P. Lovecraft, like it's about to
monster
hatch an
slime.
Elder gut. Yeah. That just based on like the lingering visage of it burned into my brain. I like started gagging when I was chewing it. So that then compared to a few months later, I went to Iceland. I wanted to end the year with like the craziest ferment that I could think of. And if you do some reading or look into the world of fermentation for very long, you'll pretty much come across a few different things that people ascribe as like the craziest ferment they can find. And Hakarl, Icelandic rotten shark meat, kind of breaks out of even that, is like a lot of celebrity chefs have pinned it as like the worst food in the world, the smelliest thing they've ever eaten. You know, it gets all these hyperboles attached to it. And I thought, okay, that has to be it. Like, one, who can turn down a trip to Iceland? Like, I wanted to go there anyway.
Yeah.
Two, it looks like the craziest fermented food I can find anywhere. So perfect. Like, I need to end this crazy epic diet with a crazy epic trip to this like northern barren wasteland where this one guy is hanging these dried dead sharks out in a shack behind his house.
That's exactly the story we got before.
Yeah. There's a couple people that make, there's four or five producers of Hakarl in Iceland. But Bjornenhofen, please forgive me if I butchered that pronunciation. I think that's it. Something close to that is this shark museum that the country has designated as kind of like the place to go. It's a little museum that's got guy's house, basically, where he makes the shark out back. So it's kind of, if you want to find true rotten shark meat, that's like the best place to find it.
In the world.
In the world. Not that you'll find it much outside of Iceland. So yeah, I ventured up there during a sideways, sleet-blowing Arctic gale. An avalanche blocked off the road. Like, it was as epic as I could possibly have. It does, I think, because you really get a sense of why they had to eat this to survive 400 or 500 years ago. Like, it was just sunny and beautiful and 23 hours of daylight. You're like, oh, it's not that bad here. Going in the winter, you're like, oh yeah, you're not supposed to be here. I get why they were really desperate. This is not meant for human beings. Beautiful country though, it's awesome. And the rotten shark meat is, I don't think, as bad as people make it out to be, but I say that because I think everyone should have to try it.
We might go to the place that the cafe that you went to first, because I know that's cafe the easiest way to go, and I had already read about that online.
Beginner shark meat, though.
Yeah.
It's not quite the same.
We'll be in there real quick now.
I
think if we're going for longer, we would be tempted to go to the Shark Museum if it's open, but we're only going for a few days, so we might just go to the beginner shark.
I actually like that one. Like, legitimately liked that version. Yeah.
Tasted I'm okay like with cheese. Training wheels before.
Yeah.
It was cheesy. It was good.
Okay.
Yeah. I would eat that again.
Right on.
Awesome. What you have recipes in the book too. So outside of beer, well, let's talk a little bit about what you're doing at the brewery and kind of what your brewing philosophy is. You do a lot of interesting things. Your blog is super interesting actually as well.
Thank you.
You do a lot of experimental kind of things. So
yeah, I mean, I think the levels of interest certainly begin to overlap as you get into fermented food. Fermented beer can't help but, you know, cross over. So a lot of my brewing philosophy and a lot of my efforts at Ken Falls Brewing Company have been into the funkier, you know, what beer people call farmhouse style beer typically. So trying 3 or 4 different methods of brewing with wild indigenous yeast and bacteria to the farm. There's a yeast culture, yeast and bacteria culture I have going with microbes that I cultured off of squash from the farm. Basically just started fermenting squash in the fall and then like pitched those into a beer and just figured that the microbes from the squash they seemed to be conducive to a beer environment based on the pellicle they formed. So I just threw them in, let them go, decided to see what would happen, and that's going really well. I have a culture going from, basically I walked around the farm with a jar and just threw a bunch of bark and squash blossoms and flowers and bees and things into the jar, let that go, and then also just pitch that into beer.
So you did like a starter with
basically decanted off all the vegetable matter, took the dregs at the bottom, and then pitched those dregs into beer wort and grew that up. And that's actually been going in barrels for over a year now. I think we are actually packaging that beer tomorrow as it happens.
Have you sampled it?
Yes, yeah. It came out really nice. Yeah, like nice, complex, aged, sour, you know, wild ale character. Really cool.
Cool.
Yeah.
I didn't get through the entire chapter, but the chapter when you first did that while they were planning on getting their brewery together, you took some apples, threw some of the hops, because they're growing hops also on the farm, right?
Hops in it, yep.
And you threw the hops into this jar, and then, you know, within relatively few hours, you saw some movement in there.
It turns out I thought I had cultured the most aggressive microbes in the world. It saw this like jet of bubbles rising out of the bottom. It turns out there was a bee in there amidst all the vegetable matter that I had harvested. Somehow, like it was a long time later, or at least for something submerged in liquid. I don't know how he didn't drown, but he made it happily out alive and hopefully imparted some microbes to the culture.
Yeah. There you go.
Undoubtedly, they visit a lot of places. So.
Yeah.
What's your probably favorite ferment to do now? Do you still, I guess beer maybe, but outside of beer?
Outside of beer. I've been so busy the last year, I haven't had as much time to get real wacky with my experiments in the kitchen as I would have liked. So my favorites have probably been some of the simpler, but like really versatile ferments that I learned from my year of fermentation. Two of the veggie ferments that I've become really fond of are two or three I can think of, I guess. I do a kind of a modified kimchi with just like Western style sauerkraut, but with the kimchi spice. Find it be a quick bit easier and quicker to make than kimchi, and I like the kind of crunch it retains and the simplicity of it. Nice compromise between making regular kraut and kimchi. I just mm-hmm. make the one
kind of like a hybrid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Make a carrot parsnip ginger ferment that I really like. Has a nice bite to it. Real tasty. That was one of my early surprises, where I just, you know, three simple ingredients and I couldn't believe how complex and interesting it tasted together when it came out. And fermented hot sauce, I find always comes out really interesting. I can never seem to make the same fermented hot sauce twice. But that's one that took me a while to kind of perfect, or not even perfect, but not terrible. And once I got the hang of it, I'm really enjoying making fermented hot sauces.
Awesome. That's something we haven't done yet.
No, we've wanted to do it for a long time. Nice. But we have all this hot sauce left over from when she judged the Screaming Mimi Awards. Like, can't make our own hot sauce.
You can never have enough hot sauce.
50 hot sauces.
We have like 70 bottles at home.
It's kind of insane. It's like half my kitchen.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's so versatile, though.
Yeah.
What is the AHA Research and Education Fund project? I know my shit.
The
effects of live culture beer on one man's microbiome.
That was a brief little experiment, just to kind of quickly see if it was possible to gauge. With this book, I wanted to kind of steer clear of trying to make any overt scientific claims based on my diet. Like, it's an anecdotal thing. It's, you know, it's one person's experiment, especially in the world of fermentation, which, you know, is obviously part of this larger movement of like kind of modern, you know, the modern look at health and all the things that become associated with it. There can be a lot of wild claims associated with fermentation a lot of times. I you know, got nervous about trying to say anything too scientific based on my diet. You know, I wanted to keep it more educational and informative, and hopefully entertaining. We did do a brief experiment where I brewed a beer, and my friend consumed beer with just a single yeast culture, I believe, for 2 weeks, and then like more of a probiotic live culture with you know, bacteria that you'd find in something like kombucha or something. For another couple of weeks, we tested his microbiome with this one service that you can send in samples, and they'll analyze what microbes are in your gut. You get the results back, and you can see what changed. Mm-hmm. It's much harder to parse apart what those changes actually mean. So he did some analysis, and no, you know, there's no real conclusions that we've been able to tweak out yet.
So you were sending stool samples for this?
Yeah, thing, right? Yeah. Gotcha.
But that's cool because you publish it on, it's published on the AHA
yes,
website. It's available. You can Google it. It's available for anyone to download and
right.
look at. And it was a cool, did you guys use their research and grant program?
Yeah, I believe, yes. I
they do some cool, there's some really interesting stuff that comes out of that. But anyway, it's cool because it's, I think, you know.
Yeah. I forget what the...
It's a neat
little
experiment.
I guess it's under... is it really under I Know My Shit?
Yeah, it says I Know My Shit.
Okay. Yep. I Know My Shit. Yeah. Okay. So I guess that's how you find it by
googling
it. It's certainly an interesting read. Yeah. It was in, I guess, Zymergy. Yeah. You know, no hard conclusions based on that. Like, it was kind of cool to
soft
see...
Soft stool only.
Right. Yes. Right. Yes. It was cool to see the changes that... you could create with just a sudden shift in diet like that. But again, nothing that you'd be like, oh, well, this is how you should lead your life, or this is what you should eat.
Right.
Yeah.
Nothing that drastic.
Yes.
But.
There are a ton. I mean, if you were interested, there are a ton of interesting studies that are ongoing right now. There's a lot of opinions are changing about, obviously, just diet in general, everything from gluten intolerance to preservatives
to
our microbiomes, both on our skin and inside our body. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of research out there right now that's ongoing, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Are you still heavily active with bear flavored?
I try. It's been
pretty
about
busy with
like one post
stuff
a month lately. Yeah, I'm hoping to be a lot more active this year, and especially when I, you know, help people engage with the book through that too. So I'm going to try to start. I've been kind of in a lull, biding my time to start building up some posts of recipes and other things to kind of share things from the book with people.
That's bear-flavored.com.
Bear, like the animal-flavored.com. And yeah, a lot of ideas that I have for, you know, bringing people into the world of professional brewing, not just home brewing, that I just haven't really gotten time to write yet.
Awesome. But. And that's something that lots of homebrewers are interested in.
Yeah, so. I think so, yeah.
Can people pre-order your book currently?
They can, yeah. It is on Amazon. You can search for The Fermenta Man on Amazon. And I'm sure you can pre-order it with your local bookstore, which is probably an even better idea.
Please go in and request it from them. Let them know it's on your radar, and it should be on their radar as well.
Also, no matter where you get it, it helps every writer if you can write a small little review on Amazon. So when you get it, get him those stats.
Good review.
Yeah, good. Yeah,
it's a bad one star, and you don't have to then. But.
I'm sure it'll be a good review. It's a great book.
It is a great book. It's really
thank
it's
you.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us
thank
in the
you
studio.
If you're going to be in Philadelphia this next week, we'll see you at the
Craft
Brewers Conference. I'll be there for
some
a couple
of
days.
Us.
one third of us. I'm very excited. I'll have a couple of nice interviews from that. Also, if you're going to be in Iceland next Sunday, I'm playing a jazz performance at the brewery. I'm very excited about that. I'll be playing some jazz at 8 o'clock at the Bryggjan Brewery, Bryggjan Brewery. So come have some beer and some jazz music.
Yep, and we're going to pack as much as we possibly can into 4 days in Iceland. We're definitely going to eat as much. I'm going to eat as much skyr as I can from as many different places. So we'll have an Iceland report when we get back as well.
Yep. What are you going to do, Rachel?
While you guys are gone.
Hold down the fort.
I'm going to hold down the fort, and I'm going to eat all of the cashew cheese you've left behind.
No, there you go.
I will say that we did, Chris and I got to attend a very special beer camp America press preview. So Sierra Nevada has done a collaboration with 30 different breweries. It was broken into 6 different regional teams. So 30 breweries outside of Sierra Nevada were involved in this from all over the country. They came up, they basically... It was a very extensive process that started, I think, last June or July, and they did 6 different collaboration beers. We got to try all of them. They were fantastic. I know that there are special designated bars that are going to be pouring them on draft, I believe, this Friday, like Arrogant Swine is one of them. Yep. I don't have a list. You could probably find it on their website. They're going to be doing a series of festivals. Anyway, we got to speak to Sam Caligioni, who was one of the regional team leaders, as well as Brian Grossman from Sierra Nevada. So we have an interview from them that we'll be playing probably next Monday, but definitely in the next 2 or 3 weeks. And the beers were great. So there is a limited number of these 12 packs. A lot of the profits are going to be going to charity. So it's a super cool event, great liquid. So super cool project. Keep an eye out for those.
That's right. Derek, thanks again.
Yep.
Wish love.
Fermented about it.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.